from the soon-to-be chilly studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another Spring Fever Hour, chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. What's the best way to ensure that spring bulbs like tulips spring up reliably in the spring, right? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, I'll provide tons of tips to help your yard become a springtime spectacular. Plus, what would we eat without women in agriculture? And your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and Natalie nuanced nullifications. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up like tulips instead of black walnuts in your front yard.
You've already discovered that this NPR station is an excellent source of news and entertainment, but did you know that this station is a nonprofit? Public radio is for the public, available to all free of charge. That is possible thanks to people just like you who give what they can to support open access to information. So thank you for listening and for making all of this possible.
Call 610-758-8810 or give online at WDIY.org.
From the successfully sniffing studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another doggone hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. And in this week's In the News, we present an inspiring story first reported by Dante Filppula Anki for public radio station KHOL 99.1 in Jackson, Wyoming. And we quote, Amy Hurt and Kelsey Mitchell are bushwhacking along the banks of the Snake River in late August, stopping periodically to listen for the faint ring of a bell. They're tracking an 8-year-old speckled gray and brown mutt named Fountain, clad in an orange harness with a dangling bell. He stopped ahead, and that means he spotted something. Hurt finds Fenton perked up, tail wagging, besides a couple of perennial pepperweed plants. She knows how to spot a large patch of the weedy invader, but Fenton can sniff out small bunches while they're still easy to control. Hurt founded Working Dogs for Conservation in Montana 25 years ago. The group partners with land managers around the world for conservation projects, from sniffing out invasive species like weeds and mussels in the Rocky Mountain West, to helping law enforcement track down white rhino poachers in Africa. They've been working with Teton County Weed and Pest for 5 years. Kelsey Mitchell captains the raft, which will slowly row Hurt and Fenton down 14 miles of river from Moose to Wilson. Mitchell says the dogs sniff out about 75% more invasive weed species than a human can find, and quicker, too. A job that would take a crew all summer, a couple of pups can do in about 2 weeks. Quote, the dogs are finding far, far more of these small patches than we ever could, explains Mitchell, so we can take care of them early. Perennial pepperweed is a slender shrub that can grow up to 6 feet tall with bright green leaves and white flowers. It is a prolific seed spreader. An acre of the plant can produce up to 6 billion seeds. But we're preventing that acre from ever happening, explains Mitchell. If untreated, dense stands of the weed would outcompete native plants that provide forage for a variety of wildlife, like birds and elk, and even hay for the locally raised cattle. Erica Edmiston, who leads Teton County Weed and Pest, says that this creative program has helped put them ahead in the battle against weeds and pests. We're winning, she proudly notes. Teton County's program faces some uncertainty with the future of federal funding after grants were frozen earlier this year. We're probably a little bit better poised to weather these cuts than some counties because our real estate market in Jackson Hole is strong, and those taxes help fund the program. But I'm really concerned about some of my colleagues that have smaller tax bases. Back on the river, Fenton is not keeping a low profile. He's celebrating his find with a squishy yellow ball. Most dogs in the program were rescued from shelters and live at the Working Dogs for Conservation facility. But Fenton lives with her. After this day-long patrol of the Snake River, he gets a day off. The 14-mile stretch of riverbank will take him and his buddy Ace, a mini pit bull, about 2 weeks to clear. And depending on the funding, he'll hopefully be back again next summer.
WDIY has been broadcasting since 1995.
This is Mayor Ken Smith. Congratulations to WDIY for signing on the air.
We're with Commissioner Frank Donches of the Bethlehem Police Department.
We welcome Dr. John on the blend today.
Bob Durow composed, conducted, and played much of the Schoolhouse Rock music.
Three is a magic number.
Step into the antidote to violence is to speak up against it.
WDIY for 30 years.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later, it is prime time for spring bulb advice. We got a checklist with so many things on it. We're certainly going to help you with at least one of them, which is better than normal for this show. And I'll tell you about it after another of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. It's good to be here. Thanks for taking the call.
Well, thank you for making it, sir. Where are you?
Bellefonte, Pennsylvania.
Oh, right next to State College.
Why, sure.
Okay, so what can we do you for?
Well, I have an 8-year-old sour cherry tree that has been overall healthy, though it's produced a few blossoms in the past 2 years and no fruits yet. But in early July, black spots appeared on the lower leaves, which then turned yellow and fell off the tree.
Okay.
And the tree has now been left naked.
Oh,
so I have two questions, basically. Will the tree recover and grow new leaves and false blossoms in the spring? And the second question is there anything I can do to prevent this happening next year?
Well, whether it will recover or not, God only knows, or only God knows. There's no way to predict. Now, you say this tree is 2 years old.
Eight years old.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, you're hurting. Did you plant it originally?
I did.
And
planted it 7 years ago.
Okay, so was it healthy for the first, say, 5 years?
Yeah, it's been healthy all along.
Okay, well, what changed?
I don't know what changed. The weather's been consistent. It wasn't too hot or too cold or too wet or too dry. We've had a crazy summer, of course, as you know.
Yeah, this started before this summer. Is the tree mulched?
I do mulch it a little bit around it, yeah.
With what?
Compost.
Okay. Well, that's good. Where's the compost from? Did you make it or did you buy it?
I buy it from the local recycling center, which sells a really good quality compost, I think.
Well, it's difficult for a regular human to tell what's good and what's bad. But because it's a municipality selling compost, they have to have analysis on paper, showing any level of heavy metals, The organic matter content, which you want to be high. And all you have to do is request that. It's like a report card on your compost. Now, have you continually used this compost?
Back from
year two, three, four?
Yeah, it's been my go-to place to get compost, and it's worked well for the garden. Everything else has been growing nicely.
Right, so nothing changed. Have other trees grown up around it?
No, it's pretty isolated where it is.
Okay.
It's full sunshine.
All right. Well, I regrettably have to tell you that these symptoms indicate a disease that's very tough to eradicate. Oh. How long did you have leaves on the tree this year? How many months?
Well, from the spring, so that started in early April, let's say, until about early July.
Did you say even early on you didn't have a lot of flowers?
Haven't had flowers at all. I had three blossoms this year, maybe I had one the previous year and none before that.
None in the first, 5 years?
That's right.
That should have bloomed the second year. Did you plant it?
I did.
How did you plant it? In other words, was it in a pot or bare root?
It was in a pot. No, let's see. I have to remember 7 years ago. I think it was bundled in some way. I dug a big hole to accommodate the root ball.
Right.
And put some good compost around it.
Okay.
And thought that would do the trick, and it seemed to be good for the first few years.
Okay, so let me tell people out there the correct way to plant a tree. Now, did you plant it with those wrappings intact?
I think I may have done that because I think that was the recommendation from the nursery.
Yeah, because they want to sell you a new tree.
Okay.
You know, think about it. They're not there to keep your expensive trees and shrubs alive. You know, they want you to come back, and they'll convince you it was your fault. No. What has happened is the roots have grown out, and they're being strangled because despite what you were told, burlap does not rot underground. You're in an anaerobic situation without oxygen. If it laid out on the surface and got wet, dry, hot, cold, it would rot. But underground, it's like those newspapers in landfills that they recover after 50 years, and you can read the front page. So that was a big mistake. That's probably the mistake here, because your tree has been struggling. Once it got to be about 2 or 3 years old and it realized it couldn't send its roots out into the surrounding soil. Number two, most people, not just you, have this misconception of improving the soil. That is totally wrong. You want to refill the hole with the same soil you removed. Because if you make a nice little womb of compost and perlite and, nice light potting mix, why would the roots ever go beyond that?
Uh-huh.
That's like having a child graduate college and you put a 100-inch color TV into their room. What are you thinking? You want them to go away. You want them to reach out. Get out of the house. So your roots were both strangled and thought they were happy. But if you practice tough love, take off all the wrappings, plant the tree high. You want a wide hole, not a deep one. And then you fill it back in with the soil you removed. Then those roots have to grow out, right? They have no other choice. And the compost goes on top as a mulch. Now, when you look at the tree, can you see the root flare above ground, the part of the trunk that meets the root system?
No.
Okay, so you planted it too deep.
Okay.
Any bark that's underground will begin to rot.
There's some rotting going on at the foot of the tree.
Yeah. You know, again, it's counterintuitive, but have you ever seen a tree growing in a forest or in the wild where you didn't see the root system?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and the roots actually enjoy the above ground air. And it doesn't have to be ridiculous, but if it's a lollipop, it's going to have a very short life. And 8 years, yeah, that's about the lifespan this would have. You can dig it up if you want. You can wait till the dead of winter, and then, well, you know, it's a summer bloomer, so you're screwed, blued, and tattooed no matter what you do here. But dig it up when it goes dormant, take that stuff off, and examine the bottom of the trunk. If the bark has rotted all the way around in a circle, use the wood for grilling. Any fruit wood is fabulous on a grill that uses wood. Apple wood is the best, but you get that natural smoky flavor. And then buy a fresh tree. Did you get it at a local nursery or did you get it at like Home Despot?
No, I got it at a local nursery.
Good, good. You can go back to them. Maybe you want to educate them. And if you do the things I said, take off any wrappings whatsoever and spread the roots out a little bit. Refill the hole with the soil you took out, spread compost around that, beginning 6 inches away from the trunk, and make sure it's not a lollipop. If it is a lollipop, don't finish up. Pull it higher. Put some more soil under it so you can see where the two parts of the tree meet. And if, like you said, if it's out in the open and all alone, it should do spectacularly.
What's the best time of year to plant one then?
Actually now. Fall is the best time, has the highest survival rate for trees and shrubs. Plus, nurseries are generally anxious to get rid of their old stock, you know, so they can bring in the inflatable Homer Simpson Santa Clauses and stuff. So you should get a good deal, and it's a perfect time to plant. But no matter what, you must water the tree deeply and longly. That's not a word. I know it. Right after planting. You want to set a hose down at the base, set it to drip, and let it run for 24 hours. Really saturate the soil. Short, infrequent waterings are worthless. You really want to soak the soil deeply once a week for the first 2 years. That's the definition of a new tree, is 2 years. After that, it'll do fine just with what nature provides.
Good.
Good luck to you, sir. And I hope your call saved others who are about to plant.
Well, it sounds like the tree that I have is not going to survive, so
no.
I'll probably have to give it a funeral.
Yes. Well, you can do that as per your own beliefs. Now's a great time to buy the new one.
Okay.
All right, good luck to you.
Appreciate your help.
Thanks,
Mike.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there that all of your garlic should be in the ground by now. But you should delay planting spring bulbs a little while longer. But don't go trying to find that time machine just yet, because we'll be right back to discuss the pioneering women in food production and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past 3 decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later, it is prime time for spring bulb advice. We got a checklist with so many things on it. We're certainly going to help you with at least one of them, which is better than normal for this show. But right now, it is time to welcome our special guest, Nancy Matsumoto, who is the author of the new book, Reaping What She Sows, How Women Are Rebuilding Our Broken Food System. Nancy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. It's great to be here.
It's great to be anywhere, as long as I'm walking. Now, your book obviously took you some time to write, right? Because you're globetrotting here.
Yeah, I mean, not as much as I would have liked, but a good, you know, the research part, maybe a good year plus.
Now, in essence, this is, and I'm going to use the wrong word here, but it is a cheerleading tome for women in agriculture, or even better, it's trying to get across to the people who run agriculture that women have been doing this for untold centuries, and they still remain an untapped resource.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, you said cheerleading. Yes, I totally believe in these women. I think of it as maybe a piece of advocacy journalism or nonfiction writing, because I'm really trying to show how these amazing women are at the forefront of fixing our broken food system and forging what I call the alt food system, which is a regenerative, organic, very short supply chain, transparent and direct and very climate friendly. And I wanted to show how the system is in really direct opposition to what we call big food or big agriculture, you know, very long supply chain, very opaque, very transparent. We don't know who's growing it, what their practices are, tends to be very extractive, depleting the soil and our environment in a way that, in the opposite way, these women are rebuilding soil, cleaning up waterways that have been polluted by many, many years of agrochemical pesticides and fertilizers. So I wanted to just show those two systems in stark opposition and show that women are really leading this alt food system.
And one thing you even say, you ask yourself the question directly, why women?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a natural question when you put women in the title. Women, as you said, have been leading and being in charge of food production and distribution for millennia. There have been matriarchal societies where this was much more apparent. But, you know, in the modern age, it tends to be men who are inheriting the farms, who have better access to agricultural education, to the farm loans. They tend to be the ones in power. And the women tend to be sort of maybe on the margins or on the periphery. And one of my points is kind of like, you know, change doesn't happen from the powerful center where you have entrenched interests and people who are doing just fine. It comes from the edges. And so in so much of my reporting over the years in agroecology, it's been women who are kind of really the innovators and pushing forward change.
And all of my gardeners out there listening to this, they know the sense of achievement when they eat food that they grew with their bare hands and they watched it and they learned from it. My fear is it's so distant and different from big agriculture now that, I mean, what's it going to take to get us to even let those ideas in, much less replace the ones we have and save the world.
Well, I think you're doing a great job at it, Mike, because your show is so accessible and fun, and you're really preaching, you know, radical no pesticides back to the land. And I totally agree that it's about the joy that all of your listeners are getting growing their own food in their backyard and doing it in a pesticide agroecological way. And, you know, what these women are doing is we're trying to sort of enlarge that circle. So say you live in a city and you don't have that backyard garden. Well, who are you going to turn to get food that's growing exactly the way your listeners are growing it in their backyard? They're the small or regional farmers. And so I want to have every leader, whether you're in the middle of a giant city, you know, to know that not too far outside for you, or maybe it's an urban garden if you're in a giant megalopolis, there are people who are growing, you know, nutritious food that's going to be helping to build soil and fight climate change, and to kind of empower people to recognize this alt food system and then turn to that and away from these very extractive big food, big agriculture products. I mean, we all live in this world that's, it's so much the air that we breathe, the superstores and the long chain produce supply that we're getting, you know, the cardboard tomatoes and the just the stuff that doesn't have no taste, has no nutrition. So what your listeners are doing in their own backyard, I want everyone to be able to access it through a local or regional, you know, good food system.
Even in big cities, one thing I've noticed since I took over organic gardening in 1990 after Robert died, is everybody has a smaller space to use, but they want to get more out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's amazing when you see these small market gardeners like the Nearings, like Elliot Coleman, Jean-Martin Fortier. They are just packing, you know, like a 1 acre plot and just making it so diverse. And part of it is that diversity, you know, you're not monocropping. And so you're really helping to build soil through different nutrients cycling through. It's very exciting what you can do with a small plot. And I think you're doing a lot to show people how it works.
But how, and I realize this is a loaded question, how do we turn the battleship? We know that the knowledge is out there. The ability is out there. And women have always led the way in keeping agriculture humanized. But how do we turn these battleships that have billions of dollars for propaganda and shelf space in the stores? How do we get people back a little bit to a humanistic way of living? Because with AI and all this, I fear that it won't be many more years before we're all living in domes and eating Soylent mm-hmm. Green.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is, when you look at the other side and the amount of lobbying dollars in Congress, the amount of capital reserves, all the things that my little alternative food system does not have, it is a very difficult battle, but I think it has to be from the bottom up, because even when you're seeing a lot of corporations talking about regenerative products and they're catching these buzzwords just the way they did with organic and kind of a lot of greenwashing. So I try to make my book really actionable and tell people how they can turn that ship around, kind of the question you're asking. And it ranges from anything to going to your local supermarket and saying, hey, can I talk to the manager? You know, there's this little organic farm right outside of town. What do we need to do to get some of their products on this shelf? You know, a lot of us really want that. To say your child goes to a charter school or you're a university student, you know, you can go to those schools and say, we want local organic sourcing. And there are organizations that do this, that really focus on that sort of mid-size procurement angle. And it's a really good lever for change. If you can get a big university to source from, you know, small and mid-sized local farms and not from big agriculture. I mean, that's really moving the needle ahead quite a bit. Or get involved in your local politics. You know, does your town or city have a food policy council? Maybe you can join it, find out what they're doing, find what they're advocating for. I belong to a wonderful food, organic food co-op in Toronto, and I'm on the food issues committee. And we talk about, you know, where are these things sourced? And I write little articles about what are these local Ontario peanuts? I want to talk to the farmer. How is he growing them? And so we're educating and we're learning a lot. You know, this whole idea of integrated pest management, I talk about in the book, where you have people in the Northeast who are kind of purists and they'll say, oh, anything that says has the word spray, I'm not touching it. I only want organic. So they're going to buy the, you know, labeled organic from Washington State. So what this organization, Red Tomato, had to do, who was really trying to bring back regional orchards, because there's such a strong history and tradition, but there's a huge level of pest pressure that the Northeast has that the Pacific Northwest does not have at all, as I'm sure you know. So they had to develop these very stringent protocols with scientists and botanists, biologists, to say, hey, this is the most, you know, low pesticide load, low if or no. But the truth is we have to use a little bit of whatever in order to grow here. So you're only using spray, you know, after the blossoms have done their thing, not when there's any fruiting in sight. They're doing a lot of weeding. They're doing all the things that they can do naturally, you know, to suppress the pest pressure. So in other words, they're growing the best possible ecological fruit that they can in New England. But it takes a lot of educating so that people will say, oh, I want to support this local thoughtful way of growing organic or close to organic. So it's very complicated. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Yes. I want to get to some of your case studies because that's really the bulk of the book. But I want to lead in with a great line from your introduction, something someone you were working with said that UN studies have demonstrated when women control the finances of a community, they share the wealth. People do not go hungry. Children are fed, and everybody gets a fair shake. It's about cooperation, not about competition. And I don't want to offend anybody. We're almost talking about the difference between men and women.
I mean, I think that there's that nurturing, wanting to feed people aspect that comes with being a woman and having children and wanting to take care of not just your own children, but everyone, just that urge to feed people. And I really think one of the tenets of this movement that I'm talking about is everyone's right to really good, nutritious food. And I think a lot of these people who are in this very lopsided fight, one of their motivations is really feeling that this is true. And how do we make it more fair? And how do we give more people access to this? And I think the number one way is growing your own. And then the next best way is finding people who are growing their own and buying from them, you know, in a small community setting. There have been a lot of studies done that show how when community farming and regional farming collapses and it all goes to big agribusiness, the fabric of the community really suffers. You lose so much local business, whether it's the guy who's fixing the tractors, the guy who's delivering the milk from the local dairy. All of these people are part of this supply chain that should be kept local, not global. And we also know, you know, we saw during the pandemic what happens when these really long supply chains break down. So it's not just a matter of food security, but it's sort of national security. And how do we ensure that with climate change, growing global instability, you know, we need to be able to feed ourselves and feed our communities and take, and as you're saying, you know, nurture and take care of each other. So a lot of it is about cooperation and mutual aid.
I had high hopes during the pandemic that it would be a wake-up call. And I was very pleased that I was immediately granted essential worker status because I was teaching people how to grow food in their backyard, which would kind of counteract a few of those supply chain problems, but also keep them from going mad inside and not being out and not socializing. I would rather socialize with a plot of tomatoes than some people I know.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much research showing how just being out in nature is so essential for our mental health. There was that really positive moment where everyone was discovering their local farmers market and CSA. Yeah, it was kind of like, I want people to remember that. I guess human instinct is to immediately go back to the status quo when the big box stores are open again and everything's on the shelves. That's easy. But, you know, there's just so much joy not only in being in putting your hands in soil, but being in a farmer's market. I love going to my local one because it's kind of my community. I see the growers, I see the bakers, there's music. It's just, you know, my group of friends that gather there, we just, one of the high points of our week.
Yeah, it is a sense of community, community gardens. I often tell people starting out, join a community garden, even if you got your own land, and just absorb what the people around you are doing. Learn from them. Talk to them. Now, let's get to a couple of these profiles. You open up in an interesting way with rural black farming because I believe that's where a lot of home gardening descended from. You worked with a quote, icon and hero of the black rural farmers, Shirley Sherrod. Tell us about Shirley.
Yeah, she's an amazing, amazing woman. She was a very young teen during the civil rights movement, and she described the conditions of living in southwestern Georgia during the Jim Crow era. And it was very frightening if you were a black person. You know, you had to be careful when you were on the roads. You couldn't go into so many places. There was just a lot of random violence, not to mention just being completely shut out of the USDA structure of loans, subsidies, aid, whatever. You didn't have access to that. So part of telling Shirley's story is to show how integrally connected the sort of, you know, growing your own co-op food movement was to the civil rights movement. So the two kind of grew up hand in hand. She ended up meeting and marrying a very famous civil rights activist named Charles Sherrod, who was part of the Students for a Democratic Society, who were a group of young idealistic college students who were trying to get blacks to register. Martin Luther King came to Albany. It was the height of that whole movement, and the two kind of grew up together. And these Southern agricultural co-ops also came out of this movement of, we don't have access to any kind of official federal help. So it's all about helping each other.
Because they didn't have access to federal help, they did it better.
Yeah. And it's amazing how big it got, the amount of technical assistance, the amount of loans, a lot of just really helping each other come up. And because they were the people who were growing the cotton and growing everything during slavery, you can imagine the amount of agricultural know-how, some of it coming from West Africa or wherever they came from originally, brought over, especially knowledge of how to grow rice. And so to take a lot of really, really knowledgeable farmers and just say, okay, we're going to do it on our own, I feel like is the template for this alternative food movement. Because, again, these are young farmers, many of them young, who aren't part of the USDA crop subsidies, insurance schemes, that these, they're all geared towards massive, massive farming and soy, corn, all of that, you know, for fuel, for animal feed. So I kind of think of them in parallel to basically being shut out. So I wanted to open the chapter with that story to say, people have done this before. It's a template. How can we learn from them and create our own systems of mutual support and cooperative?
One of the reasons you present her as very effective is she was a teacher. She was an organizer. Mm-hmm. What's the line here? All roads led to Shirley. When
yes. Everyone I talked to had a connection to Shirley. And then she got a, you know, position in the Obama administration with the USDA, but was really, there was a whole scandal. There was, you know, always pushback when they started the first land trust in the country, new communities. There was, you know, just virulent pushback. People hated the fact that they had this land, that they were helping each other. And, you know, it eventually got shut down. Same thing happened to her. You know, people misrepresented a speech she gave, and immediately, without looking into it, the administration was just trying to do damage control and fired her. And she has a whole memoir about this kind of traumatic experience. But she's kind of an emblem of this struggle from the civil rights to the Obama administration to today. Still,
when we think, if we have the knowledge, when we realize what the Freedom Riders went through, the stories of people like Emmett Till, Black people have always had to work outside the system. But what do you want people who read your book to go out and do? I've often said to authors, I want people to close your book and go do something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think children are really the future. And so if there's anything that you can do to promote good food education, school gardens, food education among very young children, because I've seen so many examples of an elementary or middle school starting a community garden and kids being so passionate about growing things and telling their parents about, or I've seen them keep chickens, you know, and saying, this is why you need to get, you know, organic free range. This is why we need to eat food that's been growing this way. So I think children are the way, you know, literally we're planting the seeds of the future through their education and their awareness of a different way to eat. I think that's really important. I think the policy piece is the way you're going to make inroads into the vast power of big food. And so there are a lot of, you know, National Organic Farmers Unions and regional organic farmers associations that are doing lobbying and education. And then organizations like Slow Food. So at every level, you can find different organizations that are trying to work on that lobbying and that legislative piece. And, you know, you can talk to your legislature about different bills that are, you know, we're in a time now where so much is being rolled back.
It almost seems to me like if we're going to at least move towards a more sustainable future, we don't have much more time left to do that. It has to come from inside. It has to be an actual rebellion.
Yeah, a rebellion against the food that you don't believe in, against the system that you don't believe in, and a very concerted effort to grow the alternative, to make it more powerful by supporting it, by doing, you know, in any way, supporting that local farmer, supporting their, you know, there's a lot of need right now because of these rollbacks. So what can we do to keep them going, to keep them growing? And this is why I try to talk about every link in the supply chain, because they're all important. If you don't have a distributor and you're an organic farm, you can't grow because your reach is not there. So I want to show how every link is really important.
Right. So, you have a hilarious story in there that gave me hope about, there's a farmer, they're growing some sort of specialty rice or something like that. It's a big seller at Costco.
Lotus Food.
Yeah, where people come in and ask for it. God, if we can get organic food into Costco, we can do anything.
Yes, and that's a great example of someone who is getting the scale that they need to be in a store like Costco. And they're moving more and more into these value-added products. So they're a rice company, but it's their noodles, I think, that are in Costco. And so they're trying to expand that. And this is another way that you grow this movement and try to encroach on the big food. You're getting into Costco, you're in there, you're moving. And the reason they're in there is because they have to move a minimum high volume, and they meet the bar. I also talk about an organic farm in Northern California that's, you know, dealing with Whole Foods, and how do they do it? So looking at these people who have reached a scale that can start competing and not compromising on values. And that's been very tricky. But, you know, I give examples of people who have done that.
We have been speaking with Nancy Matsumoto, the author of the new book, Reaping What She Sows, How Women Are Rebuilding Our Broken Food System. And Nancy, I hope that everyone who reads this takes something from it and takes a positive action.
Thank you. I really hope so, too. And it's been great to be on your show. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind all of yous out there who wisely planted lettuce and other cool season crops a month or so ago to be sure and harvest some of them before frost, and then protect the rest with floating row covers over winter. But don't go grabbing your salad green scissors just yet, because we'll be right back with the secrets to spring bulb success and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. What can you expect to hear next week? Hilarity, bad jokes, a small amount of useful information, and me. As long as these bolt cutters keep working. Boy, you know, this station must buy locks by the dozen. I'm Mike McGrath, and that's probably on the next You Bet Your Garden. Maybe. Plus your fabulous phone calls. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll be throwing more spring bulb information at you than you thought existed, because it's spring planting time, and there's lots of mistakes you're not going to make if you stay tuned, and you will, through another fabulous phone call at 610-694-8100. Bill, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. This is Bill at Yardley, PA, and I have yet again another question.
Normally, we wouldn't let somebody on the show as often as you, but your questions are darned interesting. Yardley, PA, so let's go.
Okay, well, you had this great write-up on the peppers, bringing them in, but is it possible to overwinter crops? You know, for example, plant something in the fall so it shows up. I was reading something about the prosopony period, that you have to essentially plant things beforehand, like spinach or carrots, and they'll then come up in the spring. You know, is there anything special about this, and when should I be planting?
Well, it's a really interesting term, and it refers to the Greek and Roman gods. Persephone was cursed to spend half her life in Hades because she was tricked by the gods of Hades, but she was able to spend half her time on the earth. And that was an early way of explaining the seasons to people.
Mm-hmm.
When fall and winter turned everything cold and barren, she was in Hades. But when she got out, that brought the spring with it and all sorts of plant life. What it refers to is the amount of daylight you need to grow plants.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, you need to get your plants to a certain height before the Persephone days start. And that's when we drop below 10 hours of light a day. And as I've often said as well, that light in the winter is not at an ideal angle for photosynthesis.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, now you can't go out and plant lettuce and spinach seed, even in a cold frame or anything like that, and expect to get great results. But if you plant it and there is I wrote this down somewhere. For specific times, you can look up your location on the United States Naval Observatory website for planning. Again, depending on where you are in the country, the days during winter where there will be less than 10 hours of sunlight start in November and end about the first week of February. So you want your plants to have a good size before we drop below those 10 days. And then there's a much better chance they'll thrive.
Now, what about freezing and other things like that? I mean, you know, if the plants are above ground, like something like spinach, are they going to essentially regrow in the spring? Or if it's something, say, like carrots that's, you know, more underground, do they just, you know, start up again when springtime rolls around?
They're all going to go dormant during the Persephone days. But the idea is if you have big enough plants that you've started in time, they will survive under row covers, floating row covers. On cold nights, they would prefer to be in a cold frame or a hoop house or something like that. But it's really a good thing for people to remember that 10 hours of daylight is pretty much a firm rule, even for shade-loving plants.
Now, are there specific plants that you can do this overwintering with? I assume that everything, you know, is not applicable to something like this.
No, just cold season crops.
Okay.
Just cold crops and greens and carrots and things like that. No, you can't do it with tomatoes.
Yeah, I know those. Okay. Well, I'll have to look into those. Do you know what the starting time is for your area? Because you're pretty much in the same area as I am.
You need to have them at a certain height by mid-November. Now, there's no firm rule about what that height would be, but they have to be well-established. They can't be little seedlings or something like that. And because they are cool-weather crops, you could start them as soon as you got open space, even after you harvest your garlic, for instance, and then do them cut and cut again style, and then stop cutting in time for them to heal up and go through the Persephone days.
Okay. So it sounds like starting in September would have been a better bet. We might be marginal here in October.
If you're planting from seed, it's too late.
Okay.
If your garden center has leftovers of cold weather crops, you'll do fine.
Okay. Well, for me, it sounds like I'm going to wait until next year to try it out. But now at least I know when and how to do it.
There you go. All right. Always a pleasure. Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Wong, a frequent contributor to You Bet Your Garden.
Or thanks a lot, Mike.
Question asker or some whatever you are. All right, take care, man. As promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we are calling How to Tiptoe Your Tulips Towards Spring Success. Barry in Voorhees, New Jersey writes, last fall I planted 50 tulip bulbs in my front lawn. I added some organic fertilizer and waited patiently, but not one shoot came up this spring. There is plenty of sun in the area, and I even made sure I planted them correct side up this time. Should I plant new ones? Yes, Barry, you should definitely plant new ones, because in the words of Star Trek's Dr. McCoy, they're dead, Jim. He would also then have said, damn it, Jim, I'm a doctor, not a gardener. Tulips were never meant to be grown in lawns. In the godforsaken mountains of Turkey and Afghanistan, where spring bulbs were originally discovered growing wild, the winters are bitter cold and the summers blazingly hot and dry. That's why these plants evolved to emerge right after winter disappeared, thrive in the short but perfect climate of spring, and then hide deep underground when the sandstorms strike. That long, dry period is essential, and planting them in a lawn exposes them to too much moisture from watering. As noted bulb specialist Brant Heath has famously said, dormant bulbs like to sleep in a dry bed, just like us. They can also be smothered by competition from the roots when you plant them in a lawn. In addition, tulips are the most edible members of the spring bulb family. Evil squirrels dig them up like we harvest potatoes. Deer browse on them shortly after they emerge in the spring, perhaps before you even notice the plants being there. Rabbits are also always ready to feed on those flowers. But the number one enemy of tulips is our voles. That's voles with a V, not moles with an M. Covered with fur, voles are about the same size as mice, but have shorter tails, smaller ears, and their beady little eyes are beadier than the beady little eyes of mice. Voles feed on the underground roots of plants and are famous for devouring spring bulbs. One source suggests that they can burrow a foot down into the soil to reach your tulips never-to-be. Voles do travel above ground, but you rarely see them. Instead, look for the distinctive trails of tramped-down grass they leave behind. Now, a one-stop shop way to prevent all herbivore invasions is to only plant foul-tasting toxic bulbs, like daffodils, fritillaria, and ornamental alliums. If tulips you must plant, follow this plan. When you plant your bulbs this fall, between Halloween and Thanksgiving for most of us, plant them in their own bed. Oh, and don't plant them too early in the season. It can interfere with the vernalization they need to produce flowers. Surround each tulip bulb with small sharp stones or similar commercial product like vole block. When you're done planting, remove all the tulip trash like browned out wrappers and such from the surface of the bed. Otherwise, you're advertising the presence of tulips below. Then cover up any leftover smells by spraying the bed with a castor oil-based repellent designed for mole and vole control. You'll find a variety of such products at most garden centers. Or even better, mulch the bed with several inches of dog fur, which the Dutch have found to repel evil squirrels, voracious voles, and just about any other herbivore. Bonus, the fur is also death to slugs who get wrapped all up in it and can't get out. Don't feed bulbs when you plant. The flower that will appear in the spring is already formed inside the bulb when you plant it in the fall. The time to feed spring bulbs is right after their flowers fade in the spring, when now they need food to actively grow the following year's flowers. Don't use wood mulch. This ridiculous trend of covering everything a foot deep in construction debris and other trash wood that's been chipped and painted some god-awful color never seen in nature makes a perfect home for voles. You might as well build little condos for them. When the bulb greenery emerges in the spring, spray more castor oil or freshen up the dog fur. When the flowers fade, clip off the little seed head that forms at the top of the stalk, but don't cut that stalk down low, or water can collect in the center and rot the bulb below. Do not molest the green leaves in any way. They have to stay around to absorb the solar energy that will grow next year's flowers. You can clip off the leaves after they turn yellow or brown. If you're not going to use that spot to grow anything else, you can leave the bulbs in the ground. Otherwise, dig up the bulbs and store them in onion bags in the coldest, driest spot you have indoors until fall. Otherwise, the bulbs will rot when you water any plants you put over top of them. Or just grow daffodils. Note, Barry's lawn planting was only a bad idea because of the type of bulb he chose. It has long been the fashion in Europe to plant spring bulbs in lawns, but only the small, early flowering ones, which used to be called minor bulbs, but now they're called special bulbs, like snowdrops and glory of snow. These bulbs emerge in winter, often justifying the snow in their names, and produce greenery that fades by the time the lawn needs its first cutting. Well, that sure was a lot of advice about proper spring bulb planting, now wasn't it? Luckily, you can read those details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive Question of the Week at the top of the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes! My producer is threatening to bust my bulbs if I don't get out of the studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming towards our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. And if you happen to live somewhere, please tell us where it is and visit our Facebook page, where we post new photos of our gardens and yours every day. Share your observations and feedback. Provide important and informative updates about the show. A link to the written version of the Gardens Alive Question of the Week. And links to our priceless podcast. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when a manure truck and a newspaper delivery van collided while being struck by a strange glowing meteor. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Northwood. Our peerless Prince of Profound Production is James Ziprote. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen, and our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. Special thanks to Nancy Matsumoto, author of Reaping What She Sows, How Women Are Rebuilding Our Broken Food System, new from Melville House. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and now that I am finally finished planting next year's garlic crop, I'm ready to go back to shaking you upside down to see if any quarters for public radio come rolling out. Or you could just make a contribution to your local public radio station with a credit card and keep the quarters for parking meters.